Hello, heroes, and welcome to Session Zero, a podcast exploring role-playing through a psychological perspective. I'm Steve Discont.
And I'm Porter Green.
And today we'll be discussing research on role-playing. So, Porter, we've talked a lot about the literature out there where we can for our show.
Mm-hmm. But research on role-playing is actually a really frustrating and challenging thing to find a lot of the time, especially when it's going to be on any kind of tabletop or LARP role-playing instead of on video games.
You know, I've noticed that, especially because we've tried, I think, pretty hard to back up some of the things that we say with the research where we can find it, either in when we cite it in the show or even in our show notes so that folks can find out more if they want to learn more. But it really is hard to find the content out there.
Mm-hmm. Very hard.
And so I think that's what we really want to explore today and get to figure out why that is. So this show today is going to be a little less about the role-playing game experience and more about how researchers kind of approach role-playing and why that's been a challenge.
For sure. Research, for the people who don't do it or interface with it a lot, is actually a very sort of dramatic and complicated world of weird red tape and quirks. So it should be interesting to at least learn about that for people that maybe only ever consume research.
Yeah. And I think that's actually why it's really helpful we have our guest that we have here today, because he is pretty much a professional researcher. And so in that case, Ben, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Ben Aldred. I'm an assistant professor and liaison librarian at the University of Illinois, Chicago. I work with the subjects of social work and urban planning. I have been running games for a long, long time, over 30 years at this point, and or playing games for over 30 years and running them for 25 or so. I run Fifth Star Productions, which is a local LARPing group.
And for those of you who might recognize that name, you've heard me mention it before, because it's when you've heard me talk about either the Innomine LARP that I've been in or the Changeling LARP that I've been in. Ben is the head game master for the LARPs I've been playing in for, gosh, last 7 years?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Been in Chicago a long time.
I know. Being in Chicago is the place I've been in the longest in my adult life so far.
Same.
Same.
Isn't that weird?
I'm not complaining. Now, Ben, you've done some research yourself into role-playing, haven't you?
Yes. I have a master's degree in folklore. And as part of that, I did my master's thesis doing research into role-playing games. My thesis was basically just an examination of a role-playing session through a folkloric lens, breaking it down and looking at some of the storytelling aspects of it. But I did some additional research out of that. I published an article on the use of humor in games and the way that that indicates community ties between the participants. And I also did a number of presentations on ontology and ethics in role-playing games and dialectic storytelling.
Now, when you say ontology, what does that mean?
I was looking into basically the ways in which character belief systems were manifested in games. So comparing things like alignment systems or archetype systems and just the ways that characters' beliefs in the world were represented in the game system and how that affected the way that play happened.
Were there any interesting takeaways in the role-playing research you've done that you think the heroes might appreciate?
I mean, I think that the most interesting thing I would say would probably be in my research into humor, and one of the ways that one of my conclusions was basically that games were often functioning at multiple social levels, where you had the, you know, culture of gamers at large. There were jokes that were things that anyone who gamed would get. There was the culture of people who played the specific system. So in this case, it was a Changeling the Dreaming game that I had been recording and analyzing. And so anyone who would have played Changeling the Dreaming would have been able to get it. And then there were jokes that were internal to that group of people. And there was a lot of cultural formation that really drew people closer, but, you know, functioning on multiple levels.
That's definitely something I've noticed in my own gaming. Like, you get to the point where you've been playing with a group for a long time, and you'll have, like, in-jokes mm-hmm. and catchphrases that only people that were in that game would even know.
Mm-hmm. And on a folklore level, every gaming group is a folk group. It's a culture mm-hmm. group that has its own culture, and that's a beautiful thing in my mind.
I never even thought of it that way. I actually really appreciate that insight. Thank you. So as a researcher and as essentially a research librarian, have you encountered much research itself on traditional role-playing, and either in LARP or in tabletop role-playing?
There is research out there on role-playing. There is, but it is often in, it's not a lot of it is in psychology. There's some in sociology, and there's some in a few other, in anthropology, but there's not a lot of really deeper qualitative research. And a lot of it is done by younger scholars who are not very well established.
And Porter, do you have any ideas about why it might not be showing up much in psychology?
Well, because research that's not sort of numbers-based, research that's more about process, is not as desirable in psychology journals right now. So it's a lot harder to get something published if it's based on, like, thematic analysis than it would be if it's got a result. One of the big issues in publishing right now is that journals want there to be a result. They want there to be a clinically significant number that people can go, ooh, and that you can make a sound bite out of. And most research on gaming wouldn't really have that because there isn't an aha moment in a thematic analysis.
So this would be often what's referred to in the literature as the qualitative versus quantitative divide,
mm-hmm.
where there's research that is much more numbers driven. And that's kind of what it sounds like you're saying right now is a big thing in psychology, where you need to have statistically significant findings to really make statements and find conclusions about your evidence, versus qualitative, that is looking much deeper at the content. It's looking for rich information
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
is a lot harder to make broad generalizations about because it's so specific.
Right. Also, psychology research is sort of the bastard child of medical research. Like, a lot of our tropes and our culture as researchers comes from trying to measure up to the medical model. But sociological and psychological problems do not really respond to treatment in the way that, like, drug trials do. So there's this sort of constant, you know, dialectic push and pull between what would be the best research for us to be doing for psychology and what would be the research that gets published.
Well, I feel like there's a little bit of a difference there, though, because you're coming from the clinical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like in industrial organizational psychology, you know, a lot of ours may align more with the business, you know, business research and things like that, where we're still looking at psychological phenomenon and such. But often we aren't looking at treatment. We're often, if there are interventions, which intervention studies, I feel, don't happen nearly enough, there that statistical significance is there, but it's not really, I feel, as based on that medical model.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that I would say that IO research almost follows more of a sociology culture, like a culture of groups, right? You're looking at groups of people and how they interact and how they respond to certain things and how you can qualify people into and out of groups.
Sometimes.
Whereas clinical research is more about treatment, right? The idea is how can we treat whatever the pathology is? And when you, even just from the words I just used, you can see like the antecedents of the medical model and how not really relevant to human experiences and behavior that could be. Right. Mm-hmm. Because most psychological, you know, problems, diagnoses are not discrete issues that can be solved with a pill. They're usually complex. They're usually multi-level. They're usually lifelong or based on particular lived experiences in combination.
Sure. And Ben, why is it then that anthropology and sociology would be either more welcome to qualitative research or more welcome to even just role-playing research?
I think a lot of it is that they've moved further away from that medical background. That anthropology nowadays, at least cultural anthropology, there's still medical anthropology that uses a lot more scientific and quantitative analysis. But a lot of cultural anthropology has definitely moved to the qualitative research, and very, very much is about observation and naturalistic observation at best, where there's an attempt not to intervene. And it's basically an observation of what is occurring rather than a situation where you're attempting an intervention and then seeing what changes because of it. And that's true, especially for anthropology, and I would say as well for sociology. There's a lot of move towards that.
Now, you also said that the people who are doing this research tend to be younger researchers who are less established. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if either of the two of you know why that might be.
Cultural relevance, I think.
Yeah, I think cultural relevance and just experience with gaming. Mm-hmm. I think that the people who, I think that while the overall age of gamers has, you know, gone up as time has passed, people who've grown up with gaming are still fairly young, you know, millennials and young Xers mostly. And that those folks are still early in their careers as researchers.
Sure.
Because didn't D&D come out in like 78-ish? 75?
The first editions came out a few years before that, but it was right around then.
Yeah, so then even if you've been DMing literally your entire sort of life since you were a young teen, that's still 30 years, right? So yeah. People in their 50s, mm-hmm. Which in research years is kind of like early mid-career.
Yeah, and it's an important thing to recognize is that with the amount of education that's necessary, that people aren't really at the point where they're starting research until their mid-20s at least. Mm-hmm. This isn't something where you start young. You have to go through your undergrad and then grad program before you're doing professional research, really. I mean, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, and to Howard graduate with a doctorate, I think the average age of graduation is 35. Mm-hmm. And that's when you really would start producing a lot of research is after you finish the dissertation.
Yeah. And I think that actually brings up another thing that I was thinking about, which I think one of the reasons why there's challenges and why we're not seeing a ton of academic research on role-playing in psychology is that the content may not be seen as that relevant in our field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the issues that often happens within publishing research is that for particular areas of psychology or even often in other research fields, there are usually the journals that are considered your top journals, the ones that you really want to get your research into if you want to feel respected in the field, if you want to be recognized. And they often have certain content that they see as what is relevant in the field, what really needs to be looked at. And they might look at your research that you might be wanting to do on role-playing or on people who are role-players and think that it is way too niche, way too specific, and they might say, this is not something we accept in our journal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's also the curse of the evidence-based treatment, right? Like, that's what's popular still, even now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't show that sort of direct corollary, or you're not exploring a new pathology that we've just come up with, it's just not as shiny.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's really hard to start a role-playing game where you're not letting them know that they're the control group.
Sure.
Before we, I mean, just doing research on humans in general, complicated.
Mm-hmm. Why is it complicated?
Because there's too many factors. Like humans are, we are so suggestible that depending on the heat of the drink that you hand someone before they go in to do an interview can affect how well they judge someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very complicated. It's very overwhelming, and controlling for outside variables is just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And every time that somebody like in chemistry says, you do soft research, I'm like, excuse me? Explain to me how to isolate a variable in a human. And then they get all huffy. And then I'm smug.
Another aspect of it that is part of it is because humans are complicated and because there's so much, there are a lot of hurdles to be overcome before actually doing research on humans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Human subject research is subject to a lot of approvals because there are a lot of potential harms.
Yeah. And I mean, especially in the United States, unfortunately, there's a lot of historical examples of human subject research that was done unethically that brought notable horrific harm to people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment is one of the ones I always think to, and I taught whenever I would teach ethics in my intra-psych classes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll share notes on that in the show notes because I don't want to get too in-depth on that one on this episode. But there are federal protections for human subjects in research.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as researchers, regardless of what field you're in, have to be very careful because one of the major edicts is beneficence, that we are trying to bring positive outcomes for the people who are participating in this research.
And that's a definite hurdle. Anyone who's doing research at an academic institution will have to submit their research to an institutional review board. And as part of that, they have to basically lay out what the benefits are of the research and what the risk of the research is. And that can be very hard to quantify when it comes to looking at role-playing games. I actually had to do that when doing my thesis, and that was in folklore. And I actually had a lot of problems getting it through the committee just because they didn't understand what I was doing.
Yeah, and for me, when I did my dissertation, it was like a 6-month process to go through IRB because I was doing a study. What I did was I analyzed the themes in the spouses of trans people going through transition and how they experience the process and isolation, et cetera. And I did it totally online through survey, which meant that I didn't even have to go through the extensive IRB that you would if you were doing in-person interviews. And it still took me like multiple revisions, and the committee wanted to make sure that I was not keeping anybody's information or like unduly potentially causing harm.
Mm-hmm. And I think with role-playing too, there's so much that can come up at the table if you're studying the actual role-playing process that you might not, either you have to attempt to predict for it in your IRB, or you might have to acknowledge risk management in your study. The fact that, especially depending on the role-playing game people are playing, there are very serious topics that could come up. And, you know, we've talked about the concerns of trauma in games, you know, mental illness and representation, and, you know, the outcomes that you might have from someone playing a game like Dungeons and Dragons versus someone who's playing a game like Bluebeard's Bride, the emotional impact and the experiences that are going to be there are going to be notably different.
And one of the real hurdles with that is that that's very difficult to explain to people who are not familiar with gaming. And the people who are on the institutional review boards tend to not be familiar with gaming. And so as you try and explain the myriad potential risks, they tend to see each of them as likely risks, and that becomes very difficult.
It's also a challenge when you are publishing on something that has like a sort of unique or niche quality, because the average journal article does not provide the space that you might need to adequately describe what gaming even is to people that don't do it. There are a lot of constructs and sort of understandings of like what an imaginary world is that are worth explaining. But you just don't have the word count.
Well, I think it also gets into that idea of, you know, what exactly are you studying? Are you studying role playing? Are you studying role players? Because that's, I think, an important distinction that comes down to for the research. And a lot of academic research is expected that you back up a lot of what you do with pre-existing theory and pre-existing research. And if that doesn't exist out there and it's not published, it's really hard to essentially create what is the literature review to inform your work in the first place. Because if it's not there, you can't point to it and say, well, these previous people have defined it and researched it, and here's what we're using as the standard. I guess I'm going to be the one to define a lot of this. And I think editors of journals are going to look at that with a highly raised eyebrow.
And that can be a real thing, too, in terms of just the, you know, not just the institutional review boards, but the process of peer review often requires getting experts to review your work. And if there are no recognized experts in what you're researching, then there's no one who can actually review your work, and so you're not going to get published.
Now, what makes me not an expert on role-playing games?
Well, you might be. You may be an expert on role-playing games, but you're not part of the group of experts that the journal regularly consults in order to review things for the peer review process. And until folks get into senior positions and actually get established, then it gets harder to get those articles placed.
Yeah, I want to be a little bit salty about the peer review process right now, too, because the people who do peer reviews are selected by the journal, and they most definitely are biased to old white men. Mm-hmm. And that definitely mm-hmm. reflects, if you look at the research, the body of research in general, because the percentage of queer research in psychology is like not even a quarter, mm-hmm. Despite like the relevant topical nature of it and the fact that homosexuality and transness are both things that were considered to be mental illnesses at various times. Mm-hmm. And then within that, the research that's like viable and done by people in the community is even smaller. And the peer reviewers for that research are few and far between. And that's mm-hmm. just queerness. I mean, if we get into gaming or we get into fandom, like the options are slimmer. And that sort of conservative white male base is even more problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You brought up something a moment ago about more experienced researchers and more experienced professionals. Mm-hmm. Are you referring to people who've achieved tenure?
Yeah, one of the other constraints that really comes up when it comes to research is the tenure divide in academic research.
And what is tenure exactly?
So tenure is basically professors at universities go through a process where their work is reviewed, and basically a university committee meets after 6 years to make sure that they are contributing sufficiently to research in general. And if they are, then they're offered long-term employment. Mm. So it would be more difficult to fire without cause. Now, as part of that process, there are a lot of hurdles to overcome. This is where the term publish or perish comes up, because one of the main requirements is publishing a certain number of articles within the arbitrary time limit of those 6 years. Mm-hmm. And that can add pressure to get things out fast, to get things out that are quicker and easier. And so these academics on the tenure track doing their research may choose to avoid subjects that might be more controversial, harder to get published, because they know that they need to get them published by the end of the calendar year, or else it won't count towards their tenure file.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if somebody wanted to do, say, like a folkloric interpretation of a gaming group from formation at session zero through a year of gameplay, mm-hmm. that would be something they might put off until they had tenure.
Yeah, because they would know that really doing that would probably be a 3-year project, you know, mm-hmm. between getting IRB, recruiting subjects that are proper for the research, then doing the observation, finally then taking a year to write up everything, and then maybe getting that published within 6 months. That's most of your time preparing for tenure. So,
by the way, I super want to do that study now. Just saying.
By all means.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you also don't have to worry about tenure. You're in a unique perspective.
Clinical research is a whole other ball of wax, because you still do need to have an IRB, and you still sure. do need to find some board that's going to say that you're doing your research ethically. So for me, it's more about finding a way to get like that oversight
probably,
for the research that I'm doing.
Probably tying yourself into it with a pre-existing university.
Mm-hmm. That's the easiest
connecting
way.
Connecting with a researcher and then doing the work while tied with them, right?
That's the easiest way. Yeah. A lot of large orgs also have IRBs. Like, for example, Howard Brown has an IRB within their medical. So you can do research at Howard Brown internally through mm-hmm. them. We are not nearly that big. So for me, I would probably have to start teaching as an adjunct somewhere and then get involved enough with the university to get access to the IRB.
Yeah. Or find a co-researcher that is mm-hmm. teaching somewhere and can get the IRB through with you as a co-researcher.
Yes, also that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's applicable to business research and IO and other areas too, because you said, clinical research. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are researchers in my field who are publishing, who are at like Eli Whitney, who mm-hmm. are at major corporations and major, very large organizations, but they're still contributing to the literature and contributing to research. But that's because either their companies have IRBs, or they have, just like you just said, Ben, co-authors who are with universities. Mm-hmm. So their IRB work is established and supported by the IRBs at those universities.
I personally think that things like the APA should have an IRB process that is separate from an organization. I think that might actually be A, increase access, and B, be very neutral.
One interesting thing is that some of this is just a United States perspective. There's mm-hmm. actually a lot of research going on elsewhere in the world, especially Finland. Mm. Finland has a lot of gaming research going on. Mm-hmm. So
it's the hard part there is getting it in English.
The Nordic scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, looking at our time, you know, we are coming towards the end of our session. Ben, I was wondering if there is anything that you'd like to plug or tell us where people might be able to find you.
I don't know that I have anything right now to plug, but my article on gaming humor is out there, open access. It's under my last name. I publish with my middle name as B. Grantham Aldred, because if you end up with the middle name Grantham, you might as well use it for what it's worth. but that's out there, open access. And my thesis, I think, is actually also available at the Institutional Repository at Indiana University. So if you wanted to read those things, they're out there.
And do you have a blog anywhere or where people might be able to find the LARPs that you run?
I do not really have much of a social media presence outside of my Twitter.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's Sleeping Scholar.
Nice.
All right. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And looking at that and knowing where we are,
I think I'll see you at the next session.
See you at the next session.
Session Zero is a One-Shot Network production. Steve Discont can be found on Twitter at @BarelyNormal, Bear spelled B-E-A-R. Porter Green can be found on Twitter at Dagmar Rugosa.
This episode was produced and edited by Joe Webster. Our logo was designed by Jessica Kuczynski, who can be found on Twitter at @AngryArtist113 or at the website jessicakuczynski.com, spelled KUCZYNSKI.
The song you hear right now is Hikari by I Love Brandon off his album Earth and Sky. If you would like to hear more of his work, visit eyelovebrandon.com or find him on Spotify, SoundCloud, Twitter, or wherever else you like to find your chill beats to listen to podcasts to. If you've been enjoying Session Zero and other podcasts on our network, and you value independent creators being able to support themselves and continue to create content for you, consider supporting our network on Patreon at patreon.com/oneshotpodcast.
Your contributions to the One Shot Network helps us to pay for the studio that we record in, the content that we use to represent our work, and the hosting of our and other podcasts. Becoming a contributor to the One Shot Network Patreon grants you access to bonus content in the network's secret archive, such as some of our personal gaming stories and a peek into conversations with role-playing game characters on our pretend therapy couch or in our pretend consulting office.
There are also other perks like the Gift and Book Club, the T-shirt Club, and many more. Please consider contributing today. Looking for something new to listen to? Try The Broadswords. The Broadswords is an all-woman D&D podcast focused on drama, roleplay, and subverting stereotypes. Join the Broads as they unravel the mysteries of Snowy Rushden, a land ruled by witches and steeped in superstition. Berserkers reign and spirits roam the frozen wastes. Ilaris, Keela, and Mepris all have their own reasons for journeying north, but they soon find they have something in common. They are all pawns in a divine plot.
Heroes, we would love to hear from you and hear your ideas about our show. You can find us on Twitter at @SessionZeroPod, or you can email us at sessionzero@oneshotpodcast.com.
Remember, heroes, Session Zero is for sharing information, not for therapy. If you feel like you need support, check out Psychology Today's Find a Therapist database. If you're experiencing a crisis, head into the emergency room or text CONNECT to 741-741 from anywhere in the USA. Be safe out there, and we'll see you in the next session.